You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, have you ever talked with your aging parents about their finances? Our guest says, don't wait like she did. She'll have some advice on how to have difficult conversations and the trouble we can have if we don't. Now, an Illinois resident passed away earlier this month, and public health officials think it may be the first death in the country linked to vaping. This comes as hundreds of people, including teenagers, have been hospitalized around the country with severe lung disease that might also be linked to vaping. That includes at least 11 confirmed cases in Wisconsin. It's not clear what kind of vaping products were involved in the hospitalizations and whether they were commercial or homemade products. Kate Thayer covers health along with other topics for the Chicago Tribune. She covered the story for that paper. Kate, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, let's start with this reported death now in Illinois. It sounds like we don't know a lot about it, except that there's maybe some connection to vaping. What do we know?
Yeah, so we know that nearly 200 people across the country, including many in Wisconsin and 22 in Illinois, were hospitalized for this unknown respiratory illness, and they also, the patients reported vaping. And as far as the death, all we know is it's an adult who is among those hospitalized who died, and this adult died sometime earlier this month. And that's really all that they tell us right now.
What do we know about the vaping connection for these other, as you say, a couple hundred people with this respiratory illness? We know it sounds like that we were vaping. We don't know necessarily what they were vaping.
Right. So federal and state public health officials say that it's, you know, really early in these investigations, so they don't know if these patients were vaping nicotine e-cigarettes, if there was THC, if this respiratory illness is more related to those other ingredients that are often found in these products, you know, which are can be some kind of harmful things that they use for flavoring. And also, those in the vaping industry are pointing to the possibility of maybe this is sort of like black market amateur-made vapes, but no one can confirm that either. So they really don't know much and are still testing patient specimens as well as products to try to come up with answers.
And yeah, taking a step back for people who haven't vaped themselves, used e-cigarettes themselves, people might be vaping and using a commercially packaged product. As you say, some people might be tweaking it with other additives like THC, or people might be trying to home brew their own product. It's kind of a Wild West scenario for what people end up putting in their vaping device. Is that right?
Right. That's what we're hearing. Also, just in general, this practice of vaping is still pretty new. So even the products sold in stores, we don't necessarily know that much about it, whereas we might know certain things about, you know, traditional tobacco cigarettes. But certainly some of these initial ingredients they're finding, you know, aren't so great to put into your lungs. So, but they're still trying to come up with what exactly is affecting these patients, and especially the one Illinois resident that died.
We're talking to Kate Thayer from the Chicago Tribune about mysterious respiratory ailments likely connected to vaping, not necessarily clear what kind of vaping products were involved in these cases. Kate, again, stepping away from these particular cases, you wrote a piece on kind of what parents need to know when it comes to vaping, because it's clear that a fair amount of underage users are using these products. What kind of things did you look at?
Right. So doctors and addiction specialists tell us that, you know, vaping is popular among this age group because, you know, it's easier for them to hide. It's not, like, smelly like tobacco cigarettes might be. But there is this misconception out there that it's just water vapor, and so it might be harmful. And that's just not true. Most of these products have other things in them, like we've been hearing. And there was even a recent study that showed just simply vaping water vapor could possibly be harmful because of these other additives that are in these devices. So they're basically cautioning parents that this is not a safe alternative for kids. You know, they were more marketed to adults who want to quit smoking, or at least that's what the companies are saying now, who are, of course, under fire for marketing to kids with fruity flavors like that. But really, doctors just let parents know that these are not harmless products, or it's not a harmless activity, and that they should really be watching their kids and telling them about the dangers of vaping.
And when it comes to kids using these vaping products, there's concern among public health officials that this could be turning around the gains we've made on nicotine. We've gotten better at keeping kids from smoking. This might be turning the numbers in the other direction.
Right. So smoking's on the decline, especially among young people, but vaping, however, is increasing. And the thing that they've told me is that when a young person vapes, they might be able to do it more because it is so easy to hide. So then they'll be getting more nicotine, and then they get addicted, and then that could be a gateway to using traditional cigarettes.
Now, getting back to these ailments related apparently to vaping of something, who is investigating this in a place like Illinois? What do you know about what's happening as they try to dig into the causes here?
The lead agency heading up that process is the Illinois Department of Public Health. They have called in the CDC, and the FDA is also assisting, and other state health departments they're in touch with, as well as local county health departments.
And what are you watching for next as you continue to report on vaping and this mysterious ailment?
So I think what we're looking for is, well, certainly more about what exactly these people were vaping and what is the danger here. And, you know, if these hospitalizations rise, if there's more patients out there, if, you know, God forbid there's more deaths, those are the things that we'll be looking for.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Kate Thayer, a reporter who covers health and trends for the Chicago Tribune. She was with us today to talk about the death of an Illinois resident that public health officials think may be the first vaping-related death in the country, though as we just heard, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. Coming up, are you feeling stressed? Do you need some self-help? Our guest says there might be a podcast that could help you out. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the self-help movement may be moving from books to podcasts. Our guest tells us how he found help in his personal life from a variety of podcasters. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a trip on a commercial fishing boat.
Wisconsin's fishing industry has changed dramatically in recent decades. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy hopped on a boat with the owner of Valley Fish and Cheese in Prairie du Chien to learn more about fishing the Mississippi River.
The millions of pounds of fish that I've caught, it's still peace and tranquility for me out here. It is a lost art. It's a dying art.
Mike Valley smiles while perched in his fishing boat along a wooded island in the Mississippi River.
Sitting here right now, I mean, this is just absolutely beautiful to me. To get out of that phone ringing, people knocking all day, every day, it's just like, ah.
Valley's a third-generation fisherman from Prairie du Chien. Both his father and his grandfather made their living on the Mississippi River, selling their fish wholesale.
When my father was running his markets in the mid-70s, early 70s, there was 125 part-time, full-time commercial fishermen in the area. Now, area, I mean 30 miles upriver, 30 miles downriver. Now there's five. And most of us are pushing 60 years old or older. There's just nobody left. And within 20 years, there will be nobody left.
Valley saw the writing on the wall in the early 1980s. He moved into retail as the market began to change.
In 1980, a new truck was $3,000. Now it's $50,000. Gill netting was $3 a pound. Now it's $15 a pound. And in 1980, buffalo were 30 cents a pound, and today they're a quarter.
Even as local produce and meat have grown in popularity from the farm-to-table movement, fish hasn't seen an equivalent river-to-table boost. Valley says part of the reason is that fresh fish isn't cheap. He estimates his fish cost double that off the truck.
$17.34.
The work is hard. Between running his shop, fishing on the river, and smoking his catch, Valley puts in at least 90 hours a week. He catches fish like catfish, carp, buffalo, and sturgeon.
A catfish caught out of this river by me is completely, totally, 100% different than what you're going to get off the truck. Because it was swimming yesterday, and it's smoked today. It's to die for.
But the Mississippi River is changing. Flooding has become a constant concern. When I went to visit Valley in mid-July, he said the river had been flooded since March and was still about 6 feet higher than it should be. This year is unprecedented, but Valley says it's been building for the last 15 years or so.
The river has changed unbelievable. The flooding is, you know, it's way, way worse than it was. So to give you an instance, where we're sitting here right now is about a foot deep. Well, there's no way you could set a net up here, but this is full of fish. We can't get at them up here. Where if there was no water on this island, they'd be right there in that gut where we would normally set.
What used to take Valley 1 hour to do now takes him three. The high water also brings a stronger current, which can be a fisherman's worst enemy. Spending a lifetime on the river has given Valley a unique appreciation and perspective. He says it's impossible not to become a conservationist.
Wholesale, you want as many pounds as you can possibly. You want to sink the boat every day because that's just more money in your pocket. Retail, I closely figure what I'm going to need for that day, and that's what I set nets for.
But as fewer and fewer people are making a living on the river, it's unclear who will take over these businesses.
In 15 years, my market will be gone. All the fresh fish markets will be gone. What a machine can fillet and what a machine can press out, it's the art will be totally lost. It isn't sustainable anymore. That's what the saddening part of it is. Everybody says, well, why don't you just slow down? Just quit making that, quit making this. You know, slow down. You can't. I'd rather go out, you know, like a good quarterback or rock and roll star and say, you know, I want to fall off the cliff. I don't want to climb down over the cliff.
For now, Valley will keep doing what he loves, bringing fish from the river to the table.
WPR digital content producer Mary Kate McCoy brought us this story about Mike Valley and commercial fishing on the Mississippi River. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, have you ever been in a rut and feel like you need some help getting out of it? Maybe you looked up some kind of motivational blog post or read a self-help book or two or three. According to Research and Markets, the U.S. self-help book industry was worth about $9.9 billion in 2016. By 2022, it's predicted to go up to $13 million. But our next guest says he found inspiration in a different place in podcast form. And he says lots and lots of other people are, too. Jason Diamond is a writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, and elsewhere. He's the author of Searching for John Hughes, or Everything I Thought I Needed to Know About Life I Learned from Watching 80s Movies. He wrote a piece about podcasts for the Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in your piece, you share your story. Jason, you were in a place where you needed a little something, motivation, self-help. What was going on?
You know, I've been meditating for well over a decade now. It was something I just kind of started. I like to joke that I just kind of got into it. Like, I started reading about meditation. I didn't go to any classes or anything. And I kind of cobbled together this practice of my own. And it actually started to really help. You know, my anxiety went down. I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was a kid, and I still have it as an adult. And I tried to find ways to sort of remedy that. And meditation, you know, just it really benefited me in ways that I can't say enough about it. But at some point I'd hit this rut with it, and I could not sit still. I couldn't, you know, I thoughts would pass through my head and I just start dwelling on them, and I'm like, this isn't supposed to happen. And I found this podcast by Dan Harris, who is on I believe ABC News, called 10% Happier, and listen to one episode, and, you know, they talk about what an imperfect thing it is, meditating. Like, there's no perfect, you're not going to have perfection from sitting down and breathing. Things happen, and it just started. It was like the ball in Indiana Jones. It just started rolling down. I started looking for more podcasts, and yeah.
Yeah, we talked to Dan Harris when he came out with that book, 10% Happier, before he had the podcast, and he's kind of an unlikely diplomat for the meditation world. Is that kind of the appeal of the podcast world, though? You get a perspective not from the maybe the expert or the professional or the smooth talker, but from somebody who's just kind of a person?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really, like, it was funny. I did not know that about self-help books, like how big of an industry it is, but I'd I picked up some of them in the past, and I'd watch some of this stuff online. The guys with the headset microphones talking about the power of positivity and all that stuff, and it just always seemed really off to me, and it didn't appeal to me personally. And I know talking to a lot of my friends who kind of feel the same way, who listen to these podcasts, it was sort of the same thing. And, Dan, talking to him for the piece and listening to him every week, he just seems like a really down guy. Like, he's not really trying to sell you anything. He's really genuinely interested in this, and he's learning as he goes along. And so I think that's sort of like the podcast that I tend to really gravitate towards, is where you can kind of tell the hosts are getting just as much out of it as the listeners.
Now, we'll get into some of the other individual podcasts you checked out, but once you had opened the door to this self-help podcast world, did you find there's a lot of stuff out there?
Yeah. I mean, even like I would listen to, certain podcasts. Like, I listened to Outside Magazine has a podcast, and they had a really great episode, pretty recently, actually, about just about wellness, not just wellness, but like mindfulness and the outdoors. And I was like, oh, cool. This is another avenue into this for me. This is great. But there's everything from like hardcore Buddhist podcast to I really like this. It doesn't fall under the self-help rubric, but this one called Philosophize This. I really enjoy philosophy, but it's really kind of hard to get entrenched in a great philosophical book. It's not my thing, but this the host, whose name I'm forgetting, I apologize, he does a really great job of explaining these things, and I feel a little bit more enlightened when I walk away having listened to it. And I'm finding there's a lot of stuff out there online that I'm not totally a big fan of, but podcasts, I feel like, for the most part, are actually doing us a service in a lot of ways.
Now, there's two groups of listeners out there, I assume, right now, Jason. Some people are like, yeah, podcasts, I'm into them all the time. And then some people are like, do what now? For the people who are thinking, hey, I like this idea of self-help talks that I can go and check out, how do they open the door into that world of podcast listening?
I think I tried to give a good breakdown in my piece of the ones that I like to listen to, because I think I have a very kind of like I said, I don't want anybody trying to sell me anything. I want to just kind of dip my toes into it. But I honestly find, and I hate to say this, in our celebrity-driven culture, the podcasts that had names of people I knew were really – that kind of drew me in a little bit, because, for instance, Dan had a number of tech people and musicians and writers, or excuse me, actors and writers that I liked. And I'm like, oh, this seems interesting. These people that I wouldn't think of talking about meditation. So that was a really big in for me. And another one that I really like is The Minimalists. And I'd happened to have stumbled upon their documentary on Netflix. And I am in no way, shape, or form a minimalist. I am surrounded by books and records and pairs of sneakers that I absolutely love. But I do feel like listening to them has really benefited me. So,
drop some other names of ones that you've checked out and either worked for you and you found they helped you with motivation or with meditation or whatever, or maybe some ones that weren't a good match for you, but you think other people might be interested in checking out.
One I really like that I just started listening to, I believe it's Slate. Slate has a bunch of podcasts, the website Slate, and it's called How to Raise a Parent. And I'm not a parent yet, but I did find this really interesting. It talks about basically all the things we as adults could learn from children. And I find children fascinating. They're funny. They're a little messy. They scream a lot in public. But I generally like kids, but I didn't really think to myself, man, I could really learn so much from little kids. And everything from just trying to find that enthusiasm that you had when you were a kid to just that fearlessness that kids tend to have. It really got me thinking about that. And I'm like, I'm 39. I'm not going to obviously go climb a tree and whatever kids do these days. I did really kind of get a lot out of that one. Then I also listened to the Hardcore Self-Help podcast. That's by a doctor, Dr. Robert Duff. And I really thought that one really motivated me a lot. I was really kind of surprised. I wasn't sure how I would take listening to a doctor talk about it. I thought it would be too clinical, but he really does a great job. He's really engaging and it's really fun.
Now, for some people, self-help is something that's a phrase they like. They're going to reach out for it. For other people, self-help is a red flag. It might conjure images of kind of a rah-rah booster. And as you said, and buy my product to help out. It seems like you're getting a different feel from the podcast world.
Yeah, it's like I said, I feel like I'm going into this conversation by saying I meditate, which I feel like when I tell people I meditate, then they think I'm going to start opening up some like conversation about like my new age spirituality and all these like heavy things. But I am definitely not that kind of person. So when I'm looking for something to kind of like guide me or sort of inspire me, I'm looking for something that's sort of entertaining, not too like funny and tongue in cheek, but something that I'm going to get really engaged in. And, you know, I don't want the heavy, you know, buy these crystals and, you know, do this, do that. I just want a conversation. I want things that kind of I could take away and to kind of chew on for the rest of the day. Nothing too heavy. And that's what really draws me to a lot of these.
In just our last few minutes, Jason, you started looking for these podcasts for a reason. Do you feel like they helped you?
Oh, absolutely. I've been meditating twice a day again. You know, and I have my on days, I have my off days, we all do. But it's nice to have these groups of these people who I kind of now could just have in my ears kind of, you know, not talking to me, but they're giving me something. And I feel like, especially in this day and age when there's just so much negativity out there, it's really nice to have something positive to look forward to every day.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jason Diamond, writer and author of the book Searching for John Hughes. We talked to him about a piece he wrote in the Wall Street Journal about podcasts. He says they're a new site for self-help books for stressed Americans and a little different than the self-help industry you may know and love or not. Coming up, we'll find out how to start conversations about money between aging parents and their adult children. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Keely Boltina talks to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about the closing of a major frac sand project in western Wisconsin and the twists and turns and booms and busts in the frac sand business here in the state. It's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a question for you. What do you know about your parents' finances? Not much? Our next guest says you'd be wise to find out, and the sooner the better. She writes that she waited too long to have that talk with her mom, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. If she'd put it off any longer, the situation could have gotten really complicated in a hurry. Now she's encouraging people to take action and avoid the major headaches she nearly experienced. Cameron Huddleston is a journalist who covers personal finance and the life and money columnist for Go Banking Rates. She's the author of the new book, Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. Cameron, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, you write about personal finances, and then you had a personal finance issue that led you to write this book. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. I'm almost embarrassed to admit that even though I am a personal finance journalist, I did not realize how important it was to have conversations with my mother about her finances. And as you said, it was almost too late when I started having these conversations. She was 65 when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. I was 35 at the time. And before that, before she was diagnosed, I could see she was having trouble with her memory. And I did act quickly to get her in to meet with an attorney to update her legal documents, which are so important. Not just the will, but the power of attorney and the living will. The power of attorney lets you name someone to make financial decisions for you. And if she had not named me and my sister, her power of attorney, before her memory had declined too much, the attorney would not have considered her competent enough to sign those documents. And then I would have had to go through a real legal nightmare of going through the court process, spending thousands of dollars and months to become her conservator. Fortunately, I did not have to go through that. But as I was having to step in and take over her finances, I was having to put together the pieces of the puzzle of her finances without knowing what that final picture was. And it was really difficult. And, you know, I want people to realize that if they have these conversations before an emergency arises, before the parents ask for help, before your parents need help, it's going to make things so much easier.
You write that there are a lot of psychological roadblocks to wanting to have this conversation. One is, for a lot of families, we don't feel comfortable talking about money, period, much less the money issues that might may be facing an aging parent.
Certainly, money is a taboo topic for a lot of people, and it's understandable that you might be reluctant to talk to your parents about their finances because you think they're going to push back, that they're going to say, this is none of your business. My advice is to not make the conversation about finances, as strange as that might sound. You can start by talking about big picture issues. Maybe, you know, mom and dad, what does retirement look like for you? Or how is your retirement going? Or do you think you're going to stay in this house? Do you have any plans to downsize? Or even talking about long-term care. You know, if you ever need any sort of care, what type of care would you want? Do you know how you're going to pay for it? Rather than, hey, mom and dad, I need to know how much is in your bank account. You don't want to approach it that way. You want to be very gentle. You want to respect that they might be uncomfortable with the conversation. But if they do push back, I want to encourage you not to give up. I do provide several different ways to start the conversation in my book. And there are a lot of different ways you can approach it. But if one approach doesn't work, try something else. Do not give up, because these conversations are so important.
Give us another maybe icebreaker if that one tactic, the let's talk about your retirement plans, doesn't open the door.
Sure. So you can use a story. This is a great way to start the conversation naturally. You might have a colleague who had to take off work to care for a parent. You might have a friend whose parent died without a will. You can use those examples and share them with your parents. You know, hey, my friend Bob, his father died recently. He didn't have a will. And it created a huge headache for the family. They were grieving the loss, and then they were trying to figure out who got what, and it just became a big nightmare. Mom and Dad, I want to make sure we avoid ending up in situations like that. Or maybe you have a friend whose parent died and had everything in place, and you can talk about how helpful that was for the family members who were left behind, because they didn't have to deal with that on top of the pain of losing a loved one. Using a story is a great way to start the conversation. If you're younger, say in your 20s, maybe early 30s, you're starting out in life, you can ask your parents for advice, because parents love giving advice. That's what they do best, or at least what they think they do best. And so you can go to them and say, you know, hey, mom and dad, I just got married. Do I need life insurance now? Do I need a will? Their answers are going to give you clues about what they have done, and you continue the conversation from there. Those are just a couple ways that you can approach it.
Talking to Cameron Huddleston, her new book is Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. You can call in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about how to have this conversation, what you need to talk about, or maybe your own story, for better or worse, about how you and your parents, or if you're in the parent seat, you and your kids, talked about these money issues. Cameron, a lot of people might think, okay, this is estate planning and that's a thing for rich people. There's not a lot of money to pass along. This is not really a conversation we need to have. You pitch your book, though, to not that group, to everybody else. Talk about that.
Right. So these conversations aren't necessarily, or really not at all, about what you're hoping to get. And you certainly shouldn't approach it that way, saying, mom and dad, let's talk about your will because I want to know what I'm getting. That's a surefire way to get your parents to shut down really quickly. These conversations are especially important for people whose parents might be lower income or middle income, because there's a greater chance they are going to need your help financially or with caregiving as they age, because they might not have the resources for a comfortable retirement. They might not have the resources to pay for long-term care. And you need to find this out sooner rather than later, so you and your parents can develop a plan, and maybe so you can even shore up your own finances to help them out if that is something that you are willing and able to do.
And you write that in some cases, parents, the aging parents in this case, might be reluctant to talk to their kids about it because they're they're embarrassed. They're not, they don't have everything in properly labeled binders. If they have, you know, receipts and bills, they're just in a box somewhere. What do you say to the parents about whatever their preparedness level is here?
I first want to say that for anyone out there who's thinking they don't need to have this conversation because they think their parents are on top of everything, think again. There is a very good chance your parents don't have a will. You know, less than half of adults actually have a will. They don't have a power of attorney. A very small percentage of adults have long-term care insurance to help cover the cost of long-term care. You know, a lot of baby boomers don't even have anything saved for retirement. So there is a good chance that your parents might not be financially prepared for their older age. And because of this, they might be embarrassed, and therefore they're going to be reluctant to talk with you. So you certainly, as you approach this conversation, you don't want to make it appear that you're judging them in any way. And you certainly don't want to be condescending. You want to let them know that you're trying to gather some information because you're looking out for their best interest. You want to, you know, have an idea of where they bank. It doesn't matter how much they have in the bank, but where do you bank? Because if mom and dad, if something happens to you, I need to make sure the bills get paid. If you end up in the hospital, are you writing a check or do you have things set up for automatic bill pay? I want to make sure that the mortgage gets paid, the electric bill gets paid if something happens to you. Letting them know that this conversation is happening because you want to help them if they ever need help, and not, I want to talk to you about your finances because I think you're doing something wrong. You don't want to approach it that way at all.
We're talking about personal finance and parents. Cameron Huddleston is with us. She's written a book about how adult children can talk to aging parents about their financial future. Her book is called Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk. She says, have these conversations sooner rather than later. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this financial talk with your parents, or if you're the parent here, with your adult children? Is that an issue on your mind these days? Do you need some advice on what you need to be talking about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about talking to aging parents about their finances with Cameron Huddleston. She's a journalist who covers personal finance and the author of Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you talked with your parents about their financial situation? How'd it go? Do you think you need to talk but don't know how to open that conversation? Our guest has some advice for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Cameron, we've broken the ice. We got the conversation started. You mentioned things like power of attorney. What are some of the other key agenda items that we really have to put at the top of our list?
Well, certainly find out if they have essential legal documents, like I said and like you said, the will, the power of attorney, the living will. These have to be drafted and signed while your parents are still mentally competent. You also want to get an idea of how they pay their bills, because if there were an emergency to arise and you had to make sure those bills were getting paid, you need to know how they're getting paid. You want to get a general sense of where they stand financially. It doesn't have to be dollars and cents in their accounts, but you want to know if they're in retirement. Are they relying solely on Social Security, or do they have other sources of retirement income? Are they still paying a mortgage? Do they have other types of debt? What type of insurance policies do they have? The more information you get, the better. Ideally, you really want to get everything, and that includes every account they have, the usernames, the passwords. And I realize that a lot of parents are going to be reluctant to just hand over that sort of information. There are a few who do. I even have some friends whose parents give them an updated spreadsheet every 6 months, if you can believe that. But one thing you can do is actually get them to make a list. Write it down, because they might be uncomfortable telling you this, but if they write it down, they can put that list someplace safe and tell you how to access it and under what circumstances you can access it. And this still gives them control, because a lot of times parents are reluctant to have these conversations because they feel like feel like they're giving up control, and it's a role reversal. The kids are suddenly stepping into the parent role, and parents don't like that. So let them maintain control by writing a list for you and then telling you how to access it and when you can access it.
Let's bring on a caller now. Beth is with us in Dubuque. Beth, hi.
Hello. So I think this conversation is beautiful, by the way. We lost my mom about 2 years ago, coming up in September. And we had her for 4 months from diagnosis to her passing. And she lost control of her mental capacity. And my dad didn't know. She was the financial carrier. She took care of all of the finances. It took upwards to 6 months for us to find all of the bank accounts and to find all of the life insurance policies. And he didn't know, you were talking about the online banking, he didn't have that information. And so when we went to go look in things and pay bills, we couldn't do that because we didn't have access, and he didn't have access. And banks are not easy to, you know, transfer and, you know, sending out death certificates. All of those things are really, really super difficult. And it took us upwards to 6 months to, you know, 9 months to get him situated. And we're still working with him and having those conversations on a regular basis with him.
Well, Beth, good luck with that. And I'm sorry as that anniversary comes up next month. But an illustration there, Cameron, of how crucial this can be to do it now again instead of waiting.
Yes, I'm so glad she shared that story because I've heard many stories like that when a parent dies and there's a parent left behind and that parent hasn't been involved with the finances and that parent is struggling. These conversations that you initiate with your parents can also help them get on the same page because they might not be. And you might never actually have to get involved with your parents' financial lives while they are living. But yes, everyone does die and you have to deal with what they've left behind. And as Beth's story illustrates, it can be a nightmare trying to get access to accounts to figure out what accounts your parents even have, because I didn't have conversations soon enough with my mom about her finances before she developed dementia. There was one account of hers that I didn't even know existed, and it was almost turned over to the state as unclaimed property. There was $50,000 in that account. Luckily, I found out about it before we lost it, and I was able to use that for almost a year's worth of her care in an assisted living facility.
Beth, thanks for that call. We don't have a ton of time left. I want to share a question from Mark, who asks if there's a difference between a handwritten will and something a lawyer actually does all official-like. Is that an important distinction, Cameron, when we talk to our parents?
It is. If your parents have only a handwritten will, that's certainly better than nothing. But ideally, you would like to meet with an attorney to have a will drafted. There are low cost and free wills available online, but if they can afford to meet with an attorney and have one that's drafted to their specific situation, that's best. And if your parents don't have a lot of money to afford meeting with an attorney, maybe you as the child can volunteer to pay for it.
Mark, thanks for that question. And Cameron, we've got the Labor Day weekend coming up and then the holidays coming up later this year. A lot of people try to take that kind of time. Give us a game plan to get ourselves ready, maybe brace ourselves at that when we're actually seeing our family to at least open the door on this conversation.
Well, excuse me.
That's okay.
Sorry, allergies in the summer. Certainly you don't want to bring up sorry about that. You don't want to bring up the conversation during the middle of a holiday gathering, but
sure. If
you can wait till after the holiday meal to have the conversation, if that's the only time your whole family's together, then that's better than nothing. But don't wait till Thanksgiving and say, hey, let's pass the turkey and tell me about your will, Mom and Dad.
Fair enough. That's not
the perfect time.
We'll leave it there, Cameron. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Cameron Huddleston, a journalist who covers personal finance and the life and money columnist for Go Banking Rates. We talked to her about her new book. It's called Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. It's been 50 years since Apollo 11 landed on the moon. And while the NASA space program has made big advances over the last five decades, one thing still puzzles them. Corrine Hess reports on how a group of Carthage College students have been working to solve it.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Command engine start. 2, 1.
On a chilly morning in West Texas, Carthage College professor Kevin Crosby and three students watch their experiment shoot into space. Three plastic tanks containing different amounts of water were outside of Earth's atmosphere for about 4 minutes.
There it is. New Shepard has cleared the tower on her way to space for the 10th time.
Crosby and a team are hoping the data they gather will help them solve one of aerospace engineers' greatest problems, how to measure fuel in zero gravity. Spacecrafts have to tow extra fuel, and that can cost millions of dollars.
So there was this famous moment on the moon landing when the alarms were going off and they had 30 seconds to land before they ran out of fuel. It turns out it wasn't exactly until they ran out, but until they had to abort. But very tense and dramatic moment because we don't have a good way of knowing how much fuel is in the tank.
In 2010, Crosby and his students applied to design and develop an experiment to test an idea by Kennedy Space Center engineer Rudy Wurlick. Wurlick hypothesized a spacecraft's natural vibrations could be used to measure the fuel left in the gas tank. Wurlick believes Crosby and his team are close to solving the problem.
He really gets his students to do things that are beyond their normal duties, kind of. He gets them out there with this, actually building the experiment. We got this great data set. Even from the first flight.
Using the same idea as running a finger along the rim of a wine glass to hear different sound pitches, Crosby's team has filled plastic tanks with different amounts of water to listen to how the liquid redistributes itself in space.
Instead of using our ears, we use a lot of mathematics to detect that difference in pitch and translate that difference in pitch into how much gas is in the tank.
Crosby and the students' work has been refined several times. The early flights were short, maybe 20 seconds. In Texas, the experiment went up on the New Shepard rocket, part of Blue Origin, the space company owned by Amazon's chief, Jeff Bezos. It was able to gather data for about 4 minutes.
The idea is that you develop an experiment, you test it, you fly it, and you repeat and recycle, and that can be done on a yearly, annual basis, as opposed to traditional space where billions of dollars, one mission, do or die.
While many universities have partnerships with NASA, Kenosha's Carthage College has one of the longest continuously operating space science programs in the country. It's also the home of Wisconsin's Space Grant Consortium. Celestine Anata is a physics major with minors in math and computer science. The 21-year-old hopes to one day work at a private space company as an aerospace engineer. She says her classes at Carthage are extremely difficult, but being in the lab motivates her.
Being able to see directly what we're working towards understanding and having the hands-on application of using what we're learning really drives the motivation and the passion back forward to working in the classroom.
Anata says she wouldn't have attended Carthage if the Space Consortium weren't housed there. And now her expectations have been exceeded.
I never would have thought that we'd be able to build something that would go to space, or that we'd have NASA internships, or that we'd get to do these parabolic flights or help build a satellite. It's amazing.
Crosby's group has flown their experiment into space several times. The last launch was in January in Texas, but Crosby and NASA plan to continue their partnership, each time flying a little longer and possibly someday solving the problem that has eluded aerospace engineers for 50 years. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, fake meat products or meat substitutes are moving from the specialty freezer section in grocery stores into some of the biggest fast food chains in the country. We'll look at the rise of meatless alternatives and ask if you are a fan or not. Also, Mark Hogan, the head of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, announced that he's leaving his post there later this summer. Not a lot of summer left. He joins the show for a look at the WEDC and the projects it's worked on over the years. Americans used to join public service clubs, things like Rotary and Kiwanis, a lot more than they do today. Their numbers have gone down a lot over the decades. We'll talk about what's driving that change, and you can share your own experiences. Maybe you're in a group that is seeing a return of younger members. Plus, there's apparently an epidemic of wrong-way driving in some cities, including Milwaukee. We'll find out what's driving that. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keely Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent.
Tomorrow at 7:30, marijuana is becoming legal in more and more states around the country. But there are still questions about its long-term impact on brain development, especially for younger people. A psychiatrist joins the show to share some of the latest research. It's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, Dodge County law enforcement debuted a new social media strategy aimed at reducing drunk driving and crash deaths. We'll talk to the sheriff about their social media campaign. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.